Monday, June 17, 2013. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 782.
Do I make a motion?
And I move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on Senate Bill 782A. Motion is not debatable. Is there any objection to the motion? Not, the rules are suspended. I now move that we reconsider the vote by which Senate Bill 782 was sent to the floor to pass as amended recommendation and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, can I make a motion?
Not yet.
Is there any discussion? I've already made the motion.
Oh.
Is there any objection? Not, the motion carries. The measure is once again before the committee as amended by the dash A8 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 782 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves Senate Bill 782 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah.
Representative Hicks.
Sorry, my OLS is not working. Is there a fiscal impact on this or not?
An indeterminate fiscal impact was provided on the dash A8 amendments because of the unknown funding source, unknown staffing and support costs for the task force, and the unknown potential number of meetings.
Okay. Any further discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, motion carries, and Representative Denbrough will carry the bill for us, please.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Work session on Senate Bill 782.
I think she can go now.
Yeah.
Sure.
We're not doing
any of
that.
We're still
good on the question.
This one has the dash
about. So we're going to move the, I think, dash 3 into it, right?
Yes.
Right.
I'm good on the dash 3.
That one. I'm going to open a work session on House Joint Memorial 6. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure was heard on the 12th. At the time, we had a dash 2 amendment. We now have a dash 3 amendment. The dash 3 amendment replaces the original measure and urges Congress to propose amendment to United States Constitution that Congress and state legislatures may regulate monies raised and spent for political purposes, including money raised by individuals, corporations, and associations. States that corporations, limited liability companies, and partnerships, associations, and other legal entities are not to be equated with natural persons and rights and privileges of these entities and are established and protected through existing laws and judicial case law. That is the difference between the dash 2 amendment and the amendment now before you is the dash 3. We have no revenue, no fiscal impact on the amendment.
Representative Denbrough, Representative Hicks, do you want to speak to the dash 3 at all?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks had some concerns with the wording and not surprisingly, with his sharp legal mind, he perhaps cares more about the exact meaning of words or ramifications of words. I'm more of a poet as opposed to a lawyer. I was satisfied with the dash twos, but I think the changes he has made, and I don't mean that as any kind of negative comment about lawyers, Mr. Chair, but. I think they were very good suggestions for the changes.
Okay. Thank you both for working that out. Ready for a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move dash 3 amendments to House Joint Memorial 6.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves the dash 3 amendments into HJM 6. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. The bill is the memorial is amended.
Mr. Chair, I move House Joint Memorial 6 to the floor as amended with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves HGM 6 to the as amended to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Denbrough.
Aye.
Representative Foldy.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Excused.
Representative Kenemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hoyle.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Chair Garrett.
Aye. Motion carries. The memorial is sent to the floor, and I'll ask
Clem.
Representative Clem to carry the memorial for us. Close the work session on House Joint Memorial 6. We'll open a work session on HB 34. Wait, which one?
3344.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3344 was originally heard on March 11th. We have the measure deletes provisions relating to confidentiality of challenged ballots, directs Secretary of State to adopt rules to protect identities of persons whose ballots have been challenged, directs County Clerk to distribute upon request and subject to rules adopted by Secretary of State, list of persons whose ballots have been challenged. You have a -1 amendment. The -1 amendment has 14 days to provide sufficient evidence, allows elector 14 days to provide sufficient evidence to verify the registration of a challenged ballot, requires county to send notification to elector that ballot was returned unsigned or with a signature that does not match voter registration record. If verification is not provided, elector's registration becomes inactive after the 14th day. The 8th day after the election, county clerk may disclose as public record name of elector, residence, address, and reason for the ballot being challenged. You have a no revenue, no fiscal impact on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move -1 amendments to House Bill 3344.
Mr. Hoyle moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 3344. Is there any discussion? Representative Berger.
If this is, I'm reading this amendment, okay. So the policy difference is that the Secretary of State does rules around this, and basically there's a 14-day window where the county clerks are obligated to try and notify, and after that 14-day window, if they haven't heard from them, it becomes a public record.
After the 8th day.
After the 8th day, not the 14th day.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, there's 10 days after an election to allow for challenge ballots to allow the elector to be notified and them to return a notification card verifying their signature and have their ballot counted. We're expanding that to 14 days after the election. And if they do not return that card after 14 days, their ballot in that election is not counted and they become an inactive registrant. And after the 8th day of the election, challenge ballot names, addresses, and reason for challenge can be disclosed in a public records request to allow for contact of those individuals those last 8 days to return that card that they were sent notifying them their ballot was challenged because their signature either did not match or was not on the envelope.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, follow up.
So that now goes from 10 to 8,
mm-hmm.
That time period.
Goes from 10 to 14.
No. Under current law, after 10 days, is it a public record?
After 10 days, the election is certified.
But it is not a public record.
Mm-mm.
That's the policy change, mm-hmm. That it becomes a policy, a public record after 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, further discussion, Representative Barnhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make certain that this did not preclude the clerk from notifying a voter before the election, and I don't see anything here that prevents the clerk from notifying a voter that the ballot was challenged for not putting a signature on or not having a matching signature before the election day itself if the ballot's received early. And I don't see anything in here that would suggest the clerk can't do that.
Does not.
I think you're right.
Okay. And then the other point, I guess, is that it looks like the total time that the clerk has to consider the ballot has actually been extended to 14 days from 10.
Correct.
But this new wrinkle is this public disclosure piece. Now, when it says may disclose,
mm-hmm.
under these sections, I'm assuming we're talking about that the clerk may be required to disclose given the correct request,
mm-hmm.
under those statutes. So, have I got that right?
Yep.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You've answered my question.
Representative Berger.
One more question. Aaron, did you say that under current law, after 10 days, the election is certified, and this would mean that it wouldn't be certified for 14 days?
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Kennemer.
I guess I need to go through this may disclose one more time. I'm not clear on on that? I mean, they have the option of disclosing, so there'll be differences in the different counties, or how's this going to work?
Currently, under current law, they are prohibited from disclosing that information. So upon a request, they may disclose that information.
So it's entirely their discretion on an individual?
If you don't mind, Mr. Chair, can I defer to the Secretary of State's office, who is in the audience, and maybe able to answer that question?
Yes, we'd ask you to come forward.
Chair Garrett, members of the committee, my name is Gina Zedlick from the Secretary of State's office. I'm legislative director. I did not see who the question came from.
Representative Kenemer, would you just mind restating the question?
Did you get my question, or do you need me to restate it?
Yeah. Chair Garrett, Representative Kenemer, it's my understanding that if disclosure is required under the two public record disclosure statutes listed here in the amendment, then the county clerk would be required to disclose the names.
Follow-up?
I think that's the question I had. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions for Secretary of State?
Can I also just take a minute to clarify
Please.
That the certification of the election does not change in this bill?
No.
That, I think, is 20 days after the election.
Your staff misspoke. It just means that those ballots can't be counted after 14 days. The overall certification doesn't change.
Got it.
All right, thank you. We have a motion to adopt the dash ones. Is there a further discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, motion carries.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3344 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hoyle moves House Bill 3344 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I'm not supporting
that. Okay, there I am going to be.
Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Dembro?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
No.
Vice Chair Hoyle?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hicks?
No.
Chair Garrett?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hoyle, will you please carry the bill?
Yes.
Closing work session on
HB
3344.
Public hearing and work session.
Is there Hansel's here?
That's why he's
okay,
here.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on SCR 18. Ask Sarah Hansel to come forward, please.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, SCR 18 recognizes 50th anniversary of Aurora Colony Historical Society.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bill Hansel, Senator from District 29 in Eastern Oregon. The Aurora Colony was founded as a Christian communal society in 1856 by German-Swiss immigrants and first-generation Americans. In 1956, a centennial celebration was organized by the descendants of the Aurora Colony. Out of that event came a resolution to build a museum, and a unique treasure and history of the Aurora Colony could be preserved and displayed. The Aurora Colony Historical Society was founded in 1963 to promote interactive lifelong learning by inspiring curiosity about the heritage of the Aurora Colony. The Aurora Colony Historical Society celebrates its 50th anniversary this year. You may wonder why myself, living in Eastern Oregon, would be sponsoring such an event. Cobbler of the Aurora Colony was a gentleman by the name of George Krause, the great-grandfather of my wife. So it was through that connection. We were there for a weekend several weeks ago, about a month ago, following Emma. And I was approached by the Historical Society folks and asked if I would be willing to sponsor such a recognition on their behalf. I said I would be honored to. You'll notice that the senator and the representative from that district, I asked them to be a co-sponsor as well. So I have sort of roots there, but not direct, other than through my family. And the day that this was passed unanimously on the floor of the Senate, my grandchildren from California were pages. So George Krause's great-great-great-grandchildren were on the floor of the Senate as honorary pages when this came before us and it passed. And it's one of those things that I think any way we can do to help the good folks around the state promote their historical preservation activity, I'm certainly willing to do that. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are.
Thanks for taking the time to join us. Senator, any questions? Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on SCR 18, open a work session on SCR 18.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR 18 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves SCR 18 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, motion carries. And we'll have Representative Gilliam carry that, please. We'll close the work session on SCR 18. While we have Dexter here, let's open a work session on House Bill 3453. Dexter, would you come join us? We don't have the paperwork to move this bill today, but we do have an amendment that Dexter is going to discuss with us so we can prepare to move the bill in a day or two. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. And I'm here to just touch base briefly on a couple of constitutional issues that surfaced in the printed bill. And then my understanding is you have the Dash 11 amendments before you. Okay. So in the printed bill, that bill called for when there is a public safety fiscal emergency and the governor seeks to proclaim that. The printed bill required the legislative, both the Senate President, Senate Minority Leader, House Speaker, and House Minority Leader to agree to that proclamation. And that actually, under the Constitution, the Legislative Assembly as a body has authority to act as a legislature, but individual members of the legislature do not have any authority and cannot be granted any of that sort of authority. So the Dash 11 amendments modify that by simply requiring that the governor, in advance of issuing a proclamation of public safety fiscal emergency, to consult with legislative leadership and also the senators and representatives whose districts are partially or wholly within the territory that would be covered by the proclamation. And that's also when the proclamation is initially created, and also there's an 18-month period during which the proclamation can be in effect, and then it can be extended for an additional 18 months, and that consultation function is also required for an extension of the proclamation period as well. So that was constitutional problem number one. The second one, there was a little bit of confusion in the printed bill with the authority. The bill contemplates a county income tax. And there's a provision in the Oregon Constitution that requires territorial uniformity. So whoever the taxing authority is, the tax must be extended uniformly throughout the territory of the jurisdiction that's imposing the tax. And there was a little confusion in the bill about whether it was the governor, in which case it would be a state tax, or whether it was the county governing bodies. And the amendment clarifies that it is, in fact, the county governing bodies, so that this territorial uniformity requirement would be met. If it were the governor directly, it would be a state tax. It would have to be extended throughout the entire state. The Dash 11 amendments fix that by making it a requirement of county governing bodies. The final, it's not really a constitutional issue, but the final issue that there was a lack of clarity in the printed bill on was who had to agree to this intergovernmental agreement that is created between the governor and affected local governments, and it is in fact all local governments within, not just counties, within the area that is the subject of the proclamation, and the Dash 11 amendments provide for both counties and other local governments being required to agree to that. Those were the three points I wanted to touch on. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to pick up on that last point in Section 3, which is page 2, line 3. The consent of all local governments being requisite. So to play out the scenario then, from what I'm gathering, the governor proclaims the status of emergency pursuant to the bill, and then he must get the written consent. Let's say he wants to declare a county that has incorporated cities within it. So he wants, so he declares a county to be in a situation of public safety emergency. He must get the written consent of both the county and all the incorporated cities within the county before he can actually engage in one of these agreements with the county.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, yes, the county and cities and also other local governments within that county.
Can I follow up? What exactly are other local governments?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, special districts, that sort of thing.
Okay. Follow up? Thank you. And so page 5, line 24, which is the Section 8 counties. Section 8 of the bill, the counties that don't have the income tax provision in there. So the 50-50 arrangement that's covered in the prior sections of the bill, if a county is already spending some portion of its tax revenue on county-level justice systems, public safety systems, would that satisfy the county's 50% requirement under the other portions of the bill? So there's kind of a money match thing going here, county and state, is my reading.
Don't say money match.
I shouldn't say that. That was like a month ago we had that one, or two. And that hearing seemed to go on for about a month. But
or two.
No, but there's a matching, it sounds like. There's a 50% state, 50% county input. And so if a county is, say, already spending $3 million of its organically raised revenue on public safety, would that qualify as its 50% contribution to the arrangement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, the bill would, the way I read the bill, you would identify a gross number of public safety service expenditures.
Okay.
The state would agree to 50%, and the county would bear the other remaining 50%, which could be funded through income tax or, in the case of a county that, by the terms of its charter, could not impose an income tax, through an alternative means of assessment. I note, and the operative language is on page 2, lines 19 through 23, that actually they could use any other alternative source as well, not just either income tax or this alternative assessment. So at any, whatever resources they have could be put towards that.
And
yes,
and the resources that it would have available would be controlled by the county charter? Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hicks, the resources would be basically controlled by the county governing body.
County governing body, okay.
I mean, typically they're primarily funded by property tax revenues and other fees and that sort of thing, some of which have strings attached with them, others of which don't. But whatever is in the county general fund could be used for that.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berger.
Thank you. Thanks, Drew. Did I understand you to say that under these provisions, the governor could declare, but he could not impose any tax unless the local organization agreed to it? Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that is correct. So, but there's one distinction. Currently, counties are required either by terms of their charter or by operation of state law to go out for a vote for when they are imposing taxes, that they are required to go out for a vote, and their electors must approve the tax. This does create an exception and allows for the county governing body without that second vote by the people to impose the tax. However, it's also important to note that both the Constitution and the amendment do expressly require that any ordinance that imposes this in county income tax or other county type assessment may not have an emergency clause. So county voters could also go and circulate collect signatures and ultimately refer the measure to county voters for approval.
Follow up.
But should the governor declare, he would then have the authority to go to this county and partner up with them in consultation. I'm sorry if I'm disparaging of that, but I'm not wild about that provision. I mean, the governor could, instead of this bill, call us into special session and consult with the entire legislature about a county crisis. That is always his option, is it not, Dexter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, it is.
Yeah, instead of this, okay. So he goes, he declares, he consults. He goes to the county and says, "You're in trouble. You need to pay more taxes. You now say so, and you have the authority to impose more taxes without a vote, right?"
Without a vote of the people.
Yeah, and here's the sweetener: 50-50 match from the state. Is that what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, essentially, yes.
Thank you, Dexter.
Are there questions for, yes, Representative Jensen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm a big no.
Actually, on a line question that my concern here may take a couple of different paths.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, Dexter, you started out with some discussion about the constitutionality of this minority leader and majority leader. Could you review your statements for me? I'm sorry that I didn't completely grasp what you were saying.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the Constitution grants to the Legislative Assembly as a body the power to enact laws and otherwise exercise all of the duties of the Legislative Assembly. But it does not grant any authority to particular members of the Legislative Assembly. And so in the way the printed bill had been constructed, essentially in order for the governor to make a proclamation, the governor had to receive the approval of the Senate President, the Speaker of the House, the Senate Minority Leader, and the House Minority Leader. In my opinion, an unconstitutional delegation of either executive power or legislative power, one or the other, to those individual members. The Dash 11 amendments change that into a consultation.
Well, as a follow-up on that, the chambers are organized under a body of rules which are pretty much prescribed for legislative bodies or other voting bodies. And I guess it has something of a question of if they don't have the right to delegate party by election a member to serve some of these purposes, speaking for and in their behalf to other members of the government. That's one question. I have one other issue that's for me a real big problem with this, and it's not just in this piece of legislation. It appears dozens of times in the statutes that we have, and that's this policy of having here the president and minority leader and the speaker and minority leader. I think this is fundamentally an error. I'm not saying in terms of legality or constitutionality or but I think for us as a legislative body, it's an error for us
to doing this, we're demeaning the significance and meaning of the majority leader. The speaker is not speaker of the majority party. The speaker is speaker of the House. The president of the Senate isn't president of the now Democratic Party. He's president of the Oregon Senate, which consists of both. The majority or the minority leader, you know, occupy similar sort of roles to each other. And it strikes me, colleagues, that this is a place in our laws that we ought to go through and straighten this out. And I'm not proposing, Mr. Chair, that we do that in this abbreviated time that we have left this session, but just that I think this is fundamentally wrong, that we, if we're going to do this, then let's put in majority and minority leaders in both cases, along with the speaker and the president, sort of thing.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and that's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and I was actually going to bring up that same issue. I fully support Representative Jensen's proposal on that. I think that is overlooking the majority offices as being separate from the Speaker and the President of the Senate. But I do have a question in that he also raised, does the legislature have the ability to delegate this authority in this bill, I suppose, to the governor's office? I'm assuming they do. Otherwise, you would have flagged that, too. Since you're not allowing the Senate president to make a decision that can be consulted with, is there a legislative power that we are delegating to the governor's office to carry on with spending money?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, there is not an unconstitutional delegation here. Delegation, the issue is, do you, when you delegate a function to the executive branch, and the legislature does, which happens in most legislation, is there sufficient objective criteria set forth in the legislation to enable the governor to act, to give guidance to the governor on what to do to implement the policy choice that you made? And my conclusion is that there is adequate guidance here for the policy choices you're making. I will note that the taxing power is a generally undelegable power. There are some limited exceptions to that from the legislature. But here, the way this bill is constructed, the taxing power continues to be vested in the county governing bodies, and they must, in the performance of their legislative functions, enact a county income tax or other county assessment before any money is raised under this bill.
Follow up. Appreciate that. And on a different vein, if a local government decides not to agree with declaring the emergency, is does the state have any obligation to provide public safety in the particular county?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the answer is no. Section 3 of the -11 amendments does require written authorization from each local government subject to the proclamation in order for the proclamation to actually be made.
So the state would have no financial obligation or other obligations to provide public safety?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that's correct. And I should say it's not for in order for the proclamation to be made, but the next step after proclamation is the creation of this intergovernmental agreement. And that agreement would not be effective without each local government's written authorization.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Kenner.
Is there a precedent for this kind of an amendment that delegates authority like this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kenner, this this issue was before the legislature, I believe, in the 2011 session. And there was a public safety process put in place the details of that escape me right now, but there was a type of process put in place by which I believe the county governing body could request the governor to come in and perform certain functions on their behalf. Again, it's all off the top of my head, and I'm not entirely sure about what the terms were.
Representative Berger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more time. If I understood you correctly, all local governments would have to send a letter saying we agree or some such vehicle, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, that is correct.
So theoretically, if, say, Tillamook County were to declare this emergency and the board members of the Pacific City Joint Sewer and Water Authority objected, they could send a letter that said we object and derail the entire thing. Am I correct in that? I happen to be a member of the Pacific City Joint Sewer and Water Authority and have found their board of directors at times incorrigible. And so I'm just, not to pick on them, but am I correct in that, Dexter?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, you are correct in a sense, but it would only exclude then the intergovernmental entity that is created following the proclamation from undertaking any public safety functions that this board that you just mentioned would otherwise have performed.
So in other words, it would only be, Mr. Chair, let's follow up on that. So what constitutes a public safety? Now we're getting down to some really tricky definitions, because I would say my water being shut off would be a public safety emergency. My sewer even worse. But are we only definitionally in here talking about sheriffs and prisons? And I mean, is there some definition of public safety in here that would exclude the sewer and water?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the term public safety is not defined in this bill. So you, at the moment, you could make a pretty good argument. I would anticipate that any intergovernmental agreement that follows would define the term public safety. But right now, you could make a pretty good argument in court that the functions that you describe are perhaps public safety or not.
I bet I could if my sewer issues were big enough. Thank you.
November.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So again, just following up on that, I have another question, but following up on this one, so if, what I first heard was that, every local government had the ability to block the entire the agreement in its entirety, but you're saying that that's not the case.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembrow, I'd ask that folks turn to, that members turn to lines 10 through 13 on page 2. Of the amendment, yeah. And what that says is you enter into this intergovernmental agreement for the performance of functions and activities related to public safety, that a unit of local government that is a party to the agreement or its officers or agencies have authority to perform. And so that's what's important. If it is some kind of special district that, or other local government that does not perform particular public safety services, the fact that they aren't agreeing to this does not constrain what functions are going to be performed. And it's really the agreement that is going to identify precisely what services are subject to this, and by the agreement silence what services are not subject to it.
Okay, follow up. So they're not involved in the decision on how to tax, do a tax. That's only the county that is doing that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Denborough, that's correct. Only the county governing bodies.
Okay, thank you. The county in question will certainly have active collective bargaining agreements with its employees. Are those affected at all by what occurs in this kind of situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denborough, existing collective bargaining agreements would be not affected. They may enter into bargaining for future
interim.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thanks, Dexter.
Thank you.
Okay, we're not moving this bill today. I sense questions. I think this is an important bill, and so I'm going to ask if members have continuing questions or concerns. Mr. Wolf from the governor's office has been heavily involved in developing these amendments, and please feel free to communicate with him with questions. But for now, we're going to close the work session on House Bill 3453. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3537.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Committee, House Bill 3537 was heard on the 13th of June, permits elections simultaneously run as candidate for more than one district office. There is no revenue and no fiscal impact on the original measure, and there are no amendments before us today.
All right. Want to make a motion?
Yes. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves House Bill 3537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. The bill is moved to the floor. Representative Kenmer, would you be so kind?
Thank you very much.
You ever gotten a bill passed this fast?
Probably not.
Thank close the work session on House Bill 3537.
But Reagan was president when he did.
Okay, a final item of business is to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 771.
And I'm just going to
be a legislator at the same time.
Would you like me to launch in?
Sure, girl.
Let's wait till we get all phone.
Yeah, I can be
This is for
Hi, Judge Barron. This is Aaron Seiler calling from the House Committee on Rules. We have just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 771.
Yes.
And if you just give me a moment, let me just introduce the bill for the members, and I will defer to the chair. And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 771A allows judge member of public employee retirement system to designate more than one beneficiary to receive retirement benefits after judge's death, changes person to persons, declares emergency effective on passage. This measure comes to you from your Senate with 30 aye votes. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure.
Judge, good afternoon. This is Chris Garrett, the committee chair. I also have Kevin Campbell here at the witness table to speak to the bill. So I'll leave it to the two of you to decide who wants to speak first. Go ahead.
Chair Garrett and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell with the Oregon Circuit Court Judges Association. I'll be very brief, and I'll turn it over to Judge Barron. This was introduced by Senator Arne Roblin on behalf of Judge Barron and the association because the judge discovered an anomaly in the PERS language related to judge members that prevented a member from designating more than one beneficiary. If you're a regular member of PERS and you're under that statute, you can name multiple beneficiaries. In this case, he was not able to, and it was important for him to do so. And so with that, Judge Barron, I'll turn it over to you, and you could describe the situation that brought this to the legislature's attention. And I want to just say thank you to the committee for considering this today. I know any subject that deals with PERS, it looks like this looks like a placeholder bill, right? But it's really not. And so, Judge Barron, with the chair's permission, I'll turn it over to you.
Please go ahead.
Chair Garrett and committee, my name is Richard L. Barron. I've been a circuit judge for the 15th Judicial District, Coos and Curry County, since 1980. I again want to thank Senator Roblin for sponsoring this in the Senate, and I want to thank Mr. Campbell for talking on behalf of this bill, and I want to thank you for allowing me to testify by phone. I'll be very brief. I know you are very busy. My wife died in January of 2012 after a rather long illness. We've been married for 45 years, and as a result of her death, it was necessary for me to change beneficiaries on different accounts and policies, and this included my Judge PERS account. When I asked for and received the forms to do that and make that change, I saw that I could only name one beneficiary, and this is unlike persons in regular PERS accounts who can name multiple beneficiaries. My wife and I had two sons, and I would like to be able to name them both as beneficiaries on my Judge PERS account. That's my brief testimony and what occurred to bring this to my attention, and I will be happy to answer any questions you have, and thank you for considering this bill.
Thank you. And so just to restate it, this simply applies to judges, the same rule that applies to other members of PERS?
That's correct.
All right. Any questions for either? Yes, Representative Hicks.
And then a basic question. So what does a beneficiary of a PERS account, get? What does that mean?
I believe with the judge's death, the benefits of the PERS account would accrue to the beneficiaries. Judge Barron may be able to go into greater detail about that, but that's the basics.
Okay. Chair Garrett, committee, and representative, my understanding is if for some reason I died before collecting my PERS, my Judge PERS account, or if I died without all of the money being paid out, then that money would go to the beneficiaries I designate. And at the present time, I'm only able to designate one of my sons, and this bill would allow me to designate both, and they would receive the benefit that's in my account.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Jensen.
Just a question. Would it be possible to designate your estate as the beneficiary, and then in, the will have the separation of the monies there? Obviously, I'm not an attorney, and this is just a question.
Chair and Representative, I think the bill, the present law, and this doesn't and this bill does not change the present law, would it now allow me to name a personal representative of an estate. Of course, many people don't have a large estate in which they would have to do that, and they can designate people as beneficiaries in other ways, so there wouldn't be an estate. And some people may actually need an estate because of the size of the estate or for other reasons, but so it would allow you to name a personal representative, and it would allow you to do certain things in a will that may or may not have to be probated, again, depending on the size of the reasons that you would that would come up that would make you have to have an estate.
Follow-up?
Yes, thank you. And everybody, please understand that my question here was not to be looking for alternative answers. I find the judge's request to be a very reasonable request, and I know we're not in work session, I don't think right now, I certainly would not have any trouble supporting a bill of this nature.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any other questions for either of our witnesses? Representative Kenemer?
Just more out of curiosity than anything, do we know why there's this inconsistency?
Chair Garrett and Representative Kenemer, no, we really don't. It was discovered in this manner accidentally. So,
okay. All right. Thank you, Judge, for joining us. And Mr. Campbell, thank you for your testimony. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 771 and open a work session on Senate Bill 771.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 771A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Hicks moves Senate Bill 771 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. And Representative Hicks, carry the bill, please.
Yes.
I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 771. Judge, thank you again. We're going to disconnect now.
I did.
All right. And with no further business, please adjourn. Thank you.